This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are more than a few issues in America about which we just can't seem to agree. At the top of the list in recent years is what to do about guns. The number of guns here is astronomical, and the level of gun violence is off the charts. It cannot be compared to anywhere else in the world because no country has levels even remotely approaching ours. We have a Second Amendment constitutional right to bear arms, and that acts like a firewall, pretty much stopping conversation as each side stands their ground on either side of the wall. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke about guns on this program with a group of gun owners, people standing firm in their right to own firearms, but who also believe in being a responsible gun owner. Today, we hear from the other side, from people who are concerned about the proliferation of guns and of gun violence. Ladd Everett is Director of Communications at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, an organization seeking to secure freedom from gun violence through research, strategic engagement, and effective policy advocacy. Mr. Everett joins us from the studios at WAMU in Washington, D.C. Good morning and welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. As part of your job with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, you have called for sensible gun laws. How would you characterize the laws that are presently on the books? And I know they differ from state to state, but how would you characterize them in general?
Well, they're incredibly weak. You noted the levels of gun violence in this country. And, you know, when you compare our gun laws to the gun laws of other free nations, what you find is that, our gun laws are ridden with loopholes. In this country, we routinely allow people with a history of violence to obtain firearms, often legally. Very frequently, we also allow them legally to carry guns in public. We just don't do much in this country to prevent dangerous people from obtaining and carrying firearms, and that really distinguishes us from other high-income nations.
How many of those loopholes were purposeful, intentional, versus oversights or unintended consequences of the way legislation was written?
Well, it's probably somewhat of a mix, but, you know, to be clear, the National Rifle Association, you know, constantly writes loopholes into the law on purpose. Probably the most prominent example, the one that we talk about the most, would be the private sales loophole. These laws in approximately 40 states that allow private individuals to sell guns without conducting any background checks or maintaining any records of sale. And things like that are very much on purpose. You know, the National Rifle Association is in the business of selling guns. They have gun industry executives that sit right on their board of directors. They receive millions and millions of dollars in direct corporate contributions from gun companies every year. And they want to make that sale, whether the person buying that gun is the most law-abiding, upstanding individual in your community or whether it's the guy beating his wife. I think to them it really doesn't matter. And that's, I think, why we continue to deal with this problem today.
You came to your position at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence after serving in a volunteer capacity with the Washington, D.C. Crisis Response Team, which offers, as I'm told, comfort, support, and referral services to victims and survivors of homicide in the District of Columbia. Can you share with us the magnitude of the problem that you saw there and its impact on the people who you were helping?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was hard work. What we would do is we would go out and we would, go address people who had just lost loved ones to homicide. We would talk through them, topics about, what financial assistance they could obtain from the city. We would pray with them and we would just let them know that someone was there for them and that we cared. It was difficult, and the calls came in constantly. The work that we did was just constant. And, obviously the District of Columbia has still to this day a significant gun violence problem, although they've been able to reduce the number of gun-related homicides in the city significantly over the past 15 to 20 years. But, it's a serious problem, not just in the district, but in also many other major cities in the country. And the real problem that the district faces is that despite the fact that there are very tough gun laws here in this city, 98% of their crime guns are brought in from outside states with very weak gun laws. So gun laws in this country are very much like a chain. We often say that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And that principle holds when it comes to gun trafficking as well. Criminals do know where to go to get guns, and they go to jurisdictions that have weak gun laws to obtain them.
Ladd Everett is Director of Communications at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. We're going to be joined now by two moms from the local area who are also with another organization. Christy Clark is a Huntersville mom and volunteer North Carolina chapter leader of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Welcome, Christy.
Hi.
And she's in our studio along with Misty Uribe, a Morrisville mom and volunteer Be Smart lead for the state chapter of that same organization. She's also national spokesperson for their Be Smart campaign. Thank you for being here
Thank you.
Misty, you came to Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense after a personal and very frightening brush with gun violence with your son.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
It was the end of March, and my son was playing outside at the next door neighbor's house with three other friends, and they were playing cops and robbers. Two were the robbers and two were the cops. And my son and the neighbor's child went in the shed because they were in prison. And in the shed that they normally play in, it wasn't an abnormal thing. The neighbor's son got a loaded and unsecure rifle, and was playing with it. And my son ran out of the shed, and
Because he knew it was real?
He did. He ran out of the shed and shut the doors back, and then the doors opened again, and the little boy shot one of their other little friends in the face. And he did survive. But my son was horrified after that happened, that he had to witness that.
And you soon discovered, as I understand it, that the punishment for a gun owner who negligently leaves an unsecured gun accessible to children is simply charged with a misdemeanor.
Yes. after I found that out, we had to take my son to the sheriff's station to give his statement about what happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the sheriff told me, chances are he's going to get his gun back. He has no priors, so it's just going to be a misdemeanor. And it was kind of out of his hands. So...
Was leaving the gun in the shed a normal thing, or was
it was an
oversight on his part? He just accidentally left it there?
You don't accidentally ever just leave a gun laying anywhere. Mm-hmm. So it was carelessness on his part.
So what should the punishment be for something like that, in your opinion?
In my opinion, that's hard to – that is – it's really, really hard to say in my opinion because I have been touched by that.
Right.
So I – obviously
you're
would
emotional about it.
Right.
Yeah.
I would want it to be way more harsh than it is right now, because a misdemeanor is that's just not cutting it.
And Christy, you came to the organization at the time of the Sandy Hook Elementary tragedy, which was horrific in every aspect. And you're the mother of three children and the stepmom, I think, to two. What was it about that shooting that got your attention and made you want to find an organization to join to work against guns?
Well, as you said, I'm a mom. And the day of Sandy Hook on December 14th, I was sitting at my desk and my coworker came out of her office and said, you need to turn on the CNN on your computer. There's been a school shooting. And I turned it on and I sat there and watched the live coverage of the children, you know, having to evacuate the school and the horrified expressions on the mother's faces. And I knew at that moment that it could be me. Mm-hmm. It was just one step away from being me. And after all the other gun violence that goes on in the country and the different shootings, I just looked at it and said, this is something I'm really concerned about, and I need to put my heart and soul into this. And so as a mom and a concerned citizen and a sister and a daughter, I knew that was what I needed to do.
So the organization that you joined, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, says that they work to address gun violence in a nonpartisan, evidence-based manner. You know, in the immediate aftermath of Sandy Hook, in fact, in the immediate aftermath of almost every mass shooting, gun sales go up. Is what you're doing working?
What we are doing is working. We are working in every state to strengthen gun laws. And in fact, in North Carolina, we just recently helped lobby against House Bill 562, which was going to remove the pistol permit process from North Carolina law. And so we had about 9 visits to the legislature, and we had thousands of phone calls and a petition with 17,000 signatures. And we showed up every time that bill came on the floor. And what ultimately happened was the pistol permit process and that background check stayed in the law for North Carolina. And so around the country, we're doing successes like that in different we've closed the background check loophole in Oregon. We're just working hard on the ground to have successes.
I don't know how many organizations like the two organizations we have represented around this table today there are in the country working to change gun laws, et cetera. But there must be, 100, maybe more, versus the National Rifle Association. Are there other organizations like, with the point of view of the National Rifle Association, also working against you?
Yes, there are in every state. I think there's, different organizations that are locally, gun rights organizations that we go toe-to-toe with them as well. The gun lobby had a head start on us, and so we've been working to catch up. We've come a long way since the founding of Moms Demand Action to make changes.
LAD is the way to do this, grassroots, state by state, versus at the national level?
Yeah, absolutely. To be fair, I think there's certain lessons that we can take from the National Rifle Association, and they've out-organized us for many decades. And, we talked about Sandy Hook a moment earlier, and that really was a turning point for our movement. That was the point where we saw so many new groups emerge, including Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, which is just a great group. And, I think since that time, there was a lot of media criticism after Sandy Hook because we couldn't immediately win a victory in the U.S. Senate immediately following that crisis. And but I think history is going to write that was the turning point for our movement, because we've caught up to the National Rifle Association in two very critical areas since that time. One area is in grassroots organizing. And not only do we have, new national groups active in all 50 states like Moms Demand Action, you also have, traditional progressive groups that paid lip service to this issue earlier that are now heavily engaged in the issue. Groups like, for example, Organizing for America, President Obama's former campaign organization. But the other area we've caught up to them is being able to weigh in financially during these election cycles. The NRA, in terms of PAC contributions in that area, I mean, they used to have that playing field all to themselves prior to, let's say, 2012. That's a very different picture now. You have former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who's the head of Everytown for Gun Safety, the umbrella group that is above Moms Demand Action. He now has his Independence USA PAC that weighs in heavily on this issue during election cycles. And you also have former Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, Americans for Responsible Solutions PAC. So I'm not a huge fan of money in politics. I think that, the great crusade of this century has to be getting money out of politics. But as long as we have this system, it's always been critical for us to be able to play on some type of level playing field with the NRA. And I think we're now able to do that.
We have an interesting comment from a listener who has emailed us, Linda, which I want to share with you when we come back from the break, because it deals with how we frame the conversation about guns. And I think some of you at this table are on that same page with her. We'll come back and talk about that in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Discovery Place, presenting Body Worlds and the Cycle of Life, the new exhibition with over 100 real human specimens displaying the differences in the human body due to distress, disease, and optimal health. Tickets at discoveryplace.org. Next Tuesday, we're going to get a little preview of the South Carolina primary with New Hampshire in the rearview mirror. Charlotte Talks heading to Winthrop University in Rock Hill for a preview. You can join us for a live discussion with political political experts to talk about the candidates and how they may fare in South Carolina. We'll be live at 7 p.m. from the Winthrop campus on the radio, and you can be there in person. Just go to WFAE.org for details and to RSVP. We hope to see you there. Tomorrow on this program, the world's population is growing toward unsustainable levels, and that will bring more poverty to the planet's most impoverished places. We'll hear some ideas for solutions tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, New Hampshire holds the nation's first presidential primary. The winners, the losers, and what the results could mean for candidates vying for the Democratic and Republican nominations.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show ahead from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, here on listener-supported public radio or 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about guns today and gun ownership and gun laws. A few weeks ago, we did a program with gun owners about the gun culture and responsible gun ownership. You can hear that online at WFAE.org. And today we're talking about the other side of this with Christy Clark and Misty Uribe, who is – the both of these are our moms. Christy's from Huntersville. Misty's from Mooresville. They're both with the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America organization. Lad Everett joins us from WAMU in Washington. He's director of communications for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Linda has emailed us, one of our listeners, more good, she says, could be accomplished by identifying the gun issue that many see as a problem as gun safety and not gun control. The words gun control put gun rights advocates on the defensive, and the point of this discussion is one of public safety. There is no point in denying one Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, but we should also consider the right of others to feel safe, and we should have a moral and ethical desire to do the best we can to accomplish that. Are all of you on that page? Are all of you in favor of the Second Amendment and protecting gun owners' rights to bear arms? Let's start with that question. Lad.
Well, I think that gets us into a discussion as to what the Second Amendment really meant. And I would say that I disagree entirely with the National Rifle Association's interpretation of the amendment. The Second Amendment was really about federalism. Remember that the Bill of Rights comes after the Constitution. And the Constitution gave a great deal of power to the federal Congress to organize, train, and equip the state militias. And that upset and worried many anti-federalists at the time who argued, and I would say rightly, that an oppressive federal government with a standing army could potentially disarm the state militias if they decided just not to arm them, which was a legitimate concern at that time. This is 1791, following our experience with the British monarchy. Mm-hmm. Fast forward. So, with the Second Amendment, essentially what James Madison was trying to do was to guarantee that moving forward, privately held firearms would be used for militia service, that the states would not have to depend on the federal Congress. It didn't quite work out that way in practice. The state militias very often were not able to arm themselves adequately with privately held firearms. Very often the federal government had to step in. And obviously by the time we get to the 20th century, the militia that our founding fathers knew disappears entirely. And today's organized militia is the National Guard by federal statute. And who arms the National Guard? Well, it's not privately held firearms. You don't go out, get an AR-15 at a gun show in Texas, and then go serve in Iraq with it. The federal government supplies the weapons used in our organized militia today. So that's changed 180 degrees. And then the other thing that's changed 180 degrees is no one in this country, except the fringe, fears a standing army anymore. The United States military is actually the most trusted institution in America in one national opinion poll after another. We no longer look at them as a potential threat. These are our our loved ones. They're our fathers, our sons, our daughters. So a lot has changed since that time. And, my argument, I think, here would be that this split decision that we had in the Supreme Court in 2008, where the conservative wing ruled for a much more expansive reading of the amendment really is kind of ahistorical. It didn't really pay attention to the history of the debate over the Second Amendment, which never mentioned individual self-defense against criminals.
In light of that ruling and in light of what Linda just wrote, do you think, since we're stuck with the Second Amendment in your point of view, that we would be better off framing the conversation as one about gun safety and not about gun control, so that would diffuse the situation from the get-go?
Well, I agree entirely with her, 100%, that gun control is a term we should never use. The term that I favor, and I think that most of the people in the movement favor today, is gun violence prevention. Gun safety is fine, though, too. That works. But, yeah, gun control is a terrible frame for our issue. It was developed decades ago by God knows who, and it doesn't have utility for us. It has a bad connotation. The NRA, through decades of their own messaging with big bucks behind it, has damaged that term beyond repair. And, yeah, we should move on. And I think we should frame the issue in a way that's advantageous to us.
And the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America feels the same way, because, Misty, you are the national spokesperson for that organization's Be Smart campaign. SMART is an acronym.
It is.
Let's go through it. S, secure guns in homes and vehicles. M, model responsible behavior. A, ask about unsecured guns in other homes. R, recognize the risks of teen suicide. And T, tell your peers to be smart. Now, a couple of weeks ago, as I said, we had people on this program who are gun owners, and they believe in securing guns and acting responsibly. They stressed that almost every 5 minutes on the program, securing guns. If everybody followed the rules, followed these rules, would you feel safer? Would we, in fact, be safer?
I think our children would be a little bit safer in the aspect of them not being able to access loaded and unsecured weapons. I think that with the Second Amendment, with the right to own guns, comes a huge responsibility. The responsibility being you have to securely lock your weapons up in sake of your children. In my case, you can't, you know, my story, you can't be forgetful about stuff like that.
Well, many people, and we've had a few on the show, will tell you that if you make them lock their guns up and lock their unloaded guns up, they have these guns to protect their families and their homes. And if they feel somebody's breaking into the house, they won't be able to have the time to get them out of the safe, load the gun, and they won't be able to protect their family. What do you say to that?
I say to that there are safes out there that are easily accessible in quick decisions.
So, and that are not openable by young people.
Correct.
Because they're designed for this. It's just, how do I say this? It's designed for the spread of an adult hand. A child could not open the safe that way. But you're saying there's time for that?
You know, I can't say for sure because I have never been in that predicament, but I would say that I would prefer my children to be safe for the time being while that's not happening. The chances of that happening is very low. So I would rather feel safe in my home all the time and to have my guns locked up properly.
So your organization says it supports the Second Amendment but believes in common sense solutions to decrease the escalating, and these are your words, the escalating epidemic of gun violence. So what are some of these common sense solutions? And when you bring them up, how are they met by gun owners?
Well, our primary goal is to increase background checks and close the gun show loopholes and the different loopholes that make it easy for individuals that shouldn't have a gun to get one. And so lots of times we are met with opposition to that. But I think that, you know, it takes 90 seconds to have a background check. And so that's just a small part of your life. And so when you have the conversation and we explain, you know, this is something to save lives, it's not about taking away anyone's rights. It's about the ultimate goal of saving lives. We, you know, it furthers the conversation.
As I understand, there are laws on the books in North Carolina requiring background checks before you buy a pistol.
That's correct.
If you can't pass the background check to buy a pistol and you're denied that, you can turn around and buy a rifle.
That's correct.
That's a loophole.
It is.
Does anybody understand why that loophole exists? It seems to make absolutely no logical sense whatsoever.
Well, you know, as we talked earlier, the gun lobby has a strong influence on laws and gun laws in states. And so they, you know, will lobby to have guns that can be obtained without a background check. And so that's one of the reasons why that remains on the books. It is one of the most frightening things in North Carolina. You can buy a rifle and you don't have to have a permit. You don't have to have training to use it. And then you can also open carry it almost anywhere in the state.
Mm. Vlad, the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence advocates universal background checks. What would that mean?
Well, basically, you know, that's the priority, I think, for the entire gun violence prevention movement at the federal level. It's something we've been trying to get through Congress. And essentially what it means is that you would require private sales to involve both background checks, and also the seller would have to maintain some record of sale. There are many states now, I think some approximately 20 states regulate private sales to some degree. And typically what this would mean in practice is essentially if you're a private individual and you want to sell a gun, you know, you take that transaction to a federally licensed firearms dealer. You have them run that background check, and, you know, 90% of these checks are done in 2 minutes. They're not burdensome.
But is that
and
really,
then that seller
is it,
maintains a record.
But is that really practical? I mean, we live in a nation awash with guns, and criminals are going to sell guns to other criminals, and they're not, because they're criminals, are not going to follow the law. They're not going to go to a gun store and make the trade there and have it registered, are they?
Well, first of all, what you're describing there is a private transfer. You know, you're describing a person-to-person transfer,
right,
where no background check is required. The idea is to regulate that and to punish the people that threaten public safety by moving guns in that fashion, you know, with no accountability, without checking any background on the buyer.
So what you're acknowledging is that criminals aren't going to do what a non-criminal is going to do. I mean, if I'm going to sell what you're saying is
that's a nonsensical argument.
How can that be nonsensical? You're saying
it's nonsensical. Yeah, that's an argument developed by the NRA. That's nonsensical. The argument goes like this. Criminals don't obey laws, so why should we have laws? And, Mike, I think you realize at the end of it that is an argument for anarchy.
Well, if you let me finish my thought.
I don't think it's a revelation. Number one, I don't think it's a revelation that criminals can break laws. I think mankind has understood that since the first law was made, mm-hmm, 2,000 years ago, obviously. But the point of laws is that when people do engage in behavior that's a threat to public safety, you hold them accountable under the law. You punish them. You put them in prison if they're that great a threat. And you deter them by having those types of punishments. So, no, that's a nonsensical argument.
So that's where I was
going. It amazes me we're still using it.
That's where I was going with that. You're acknowledging that criminals are probably not going to follow the rules, but to make the punishment for not following the rules much more severe.
Yeah. Should we also eliminate laws prohibiting murder, rape? I mean, it's just a nonsensical argument. It's ridiculous.
Okay. Your organization, Christie and Misty, stresses the importance of keeping guns from criminals, domestic abusers, and other dangerous people. How do you do that?
Well, one of the, you know, you enact laws that make it so that if an individual is a domestic abuser, that they are, they won't pass the background check and they can't obtain a gun easily.
What if they already have one?
And if they are, you know, need to turn over their weapons,
okay,
you know, after if they've been prosecuted, a woman is 5 times more likely to be killed or murdered when there's a gun present in a domestic violence situation. So it's a big concern for us as moms and wives.
There's another argument that goes around from the other side of this issue, and that is that gun violence is perpetrated by a small number of people in our society. And those who defend the Second Amendment say that we'd all be safer if we could more quickly respond to the outlaws out there carrying these guns and using them inappropriately, that there would be less gun violence, they say, if those who might commit violence with a gun weren't sure of who else in the crowd might have a gun and be able to respond to them. Would allowing people to be armed everywhere lessen gun violence, or would it simply increase the danger, in your point of view? Misty.
in my point of view, I do not feel comfortable going to the grocery store and having to wonder if I see a gun, if they are a good person with a gun or a bad person with a gun. In North Carolina, to have your conceal carry, you only have to have 8 hours of training. I do not think that that is nearly enough to protect my children. And also, like we've said before, in North Carolina, you can open carry. That is no training. So I do not feel comfortable being in public and counting on this person next to me to protect me and my children.
Lad?
Well, look, I this one's pretty simple. If allowing people to carry guns en masse in public reduced levels of gun violence, Mike, clearly we'd have one of the lowest rates of gun violence in the world. Enough said.
Yeah, and research demonstrates that that it doesn't happen that way, that when a civilians are armed and there's a crisis situation, then they don't – it doesn't help the situation. And lots of the times in different shootings that have happened around the country, there have been people there who were concealed carrying, and they were apprehensive to get involved in the situation. They didn't want to be perceived as the bad guy themselves.
You mentioned that in North Carolina, to open carry, you need no training, and to have concealed carry, which I don't really understand, you need 8 hours of training. And police officers and military people go through hundreds, thousands of hours of training, not only to how to use the firearm, but how to react in dangerous situations. Why does that seem apparent on the face of it to a lot of people, but not to others? That, in fact, as a concealed or an open carry person who's trying to prevent violence, you might actually be causing unnecessary damage.
Right. I think that people who are not cops and a part of the military who own a gun sometimes may not think about the severity of the situation, meaning the quick reaction that you have to take, and that you might not always be as accurate as you think that you're going to be.
The folks that we had on this program last time who are gun owners and advocate responsible gun ownership advocate training. Is that a foreign concept to most people who want to protect their Second Amendment rights? Are most people against any requirement for initial training and ongoing training as a gun owner? Anybody know the answer to that question?
The NRA certainly opposes any requirements that would
require. On what basis? Require. On what grounds?
Oh, you know, basically they've flipped the arguments of our founding fathers on its head to argue that Americans are supposed to have all the rights in the world when it comes to gun ownership, but no responsibilities whatsoever, which again is an absurd ahistorical argument because militia service in 1791 was a civic duty that involved a great deal of responsibility. It wasn't a situation where, you could come out and drill and train with your militia if you felt like it that weekend. If you didn't, there were punishments there, corporal punishment, court-martial, fines, you name it. This was a serious civic duty. You had to maintain proper upkeep of your firearms and do your duty as a member of the militia. So, you know, again, shame on us for allowing the NRA to flip that on its head to the point where today in America, it's all the rights in the world and no responsibilities. Our founding fathers had a word for that. It was called licentiousness.
Lad Everett is Director of Communications for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Christy Clark and Misty Uribe are with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Honda of Concord, committed to customer service, satisfaction, and bringing excellence to the car buying experience, offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles. Details at hondaofconcord.com. And Communities in Schools, whose mission is to surround students with a community of support, empowering them to stay in school and achieve in life. Details at cischarlotte.org. New Hampshire and their primary was yesterday. Boy, that has some people quaking in their boots. And the winners and the losers and what the results could mean for the presidential candidates will be the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. Get to us through email, wscharlottetalks@wfae.org, or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Oil prices are plummeting, and yet Saudi Arabia keeps on flooding the market.
Saudi Arabia has huge reserves financially. They can get away for several years with running huge budget deficits. It's not that they're in an immediate crisis.
I'm Kai Rizdal, sustaining the Saudis, next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gun violence and gun ownership today. We had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with gun owners who advocate responsible gun ownership and training, etc. You can hear that conversation on our website at WFAE.org. Today we're talking about people on the other side of this issue, acknowledging the existence of the Second Amendment, but advocating for stricter gun regulation and gun safety. Lisa emails, a major home improvement chain in North Carolina allows people to wear guns in the open, and last weekend I was in line behind a man wearing a holstered gun and bullets on his hip. The manager told me that he sees this every day, and while there is a requirement for training, as you've pointed out, for concealed weapons, apparently open carry is allowed without any. North Carolina has become the Wild West, and we're seriously wondering about moving somewhere sane, because I don't want to be a casualty in a gunfight while out shopping. Are there saner states, lad, than North Carolina?
Yeah, there are indeed. But I think that email gets at a more important point, which is that rights in this country are a two-way street. I think we have laws in this country fashioned by the NRA that have essentially turned gun owners into kind of super citizens who are allowed to both intimidate and endanger the rest of us on a daily basis, kind of at their whim. And I think what your emailer is expressing is a very important point, which is that she has rights too. Mm-hmm. The most fundamental duty of any government is to provide for the public safety. If you're not doing that, you're not doing your duty as a government. But more to the point, the whole point of the Constitution, the very first line of it, says that it was meant to provide domestic tranquility. And we're not doing that in this country. You know, as you stated at the front of the program, we have a level of gun violence in this country far out of whack with all other free countries. So that, to me, is the more important takeaway there, that she has rights, too. And she has a right to be in a community where she's not endangered by that kind of potential shootout on a daily basis.
When you say things, I said that at the beginning of the program, that we're out of whack in terms of the gun violence in any Western nation in the world. I think any nation in the world, we have more gun violence than any of those nations. But saying that is one thing. Hearing the numbers is another. Christy, you say that shootings take the lives of 88 Americans on average every day. And that is estimated to be 30,000 Americans fatally shot just last year in 2015. Where do those numbers come from?
That's correct. Those numbers come from, Every Town for Gun Safety has a research arm, and we we use the CDC data to calculate those numbers. And so
put those numbers into perspective. Is that more people than die in traffic accidents every day? More people die from heart attack and stroke every day?
The numbers are on par. Gun violence is going to overtake death in a vehicle accident. It's already happened in several states, and it continues as it is, it will pass death by a vehicle.
Another group called Every Town for Gun Safety, and I'm not familiar with them, but they say that aside from the mass shootings that we hear about in the national media, there are other gun-related tragedies in which children accidentally shot themselves or someone else an average of 5 times a week. That's 265 accidental shootings a year involving minors. Do you think that number is accurate?
My assumption is it's under the amount that actually happens. It's hard to track that number. And I think, most of the time there are probably more. Mm. And if you follow the news, you see it every day. A 3-year-old was shot just recently by her 8-year-old brother because the grandparents had left a loaded firearm on the side table in their bedroom. These things happen every day, and they're easily preventable. It's just a matter of putting your gun in a safe and storing the ammunition separately, and that just prevents that from happening.
You, Lad Everett, you say that the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence believes that progress on life-saving gun reform, once again, this is a quote, has been stalemated by legislators intimidated by the National Rifle Association. Everybody talks about that on both sides of the issue. How do you explain the power of that organization? Is it just money?
Well, no, it's like we talked about earlier, it's also grassroots organizing. You know, they do have a kind of a fanatical core of supporters who are messaging with legislators constantly, emailing them, calling them, showing up at their town hall meetings, you name it. You know, in some sense, that's just good democratic engagement. There's also an element of intimidation there that has a much darker side. But in some sense, it's just good old-fashioned democratic engagement. And like I was saying earlier, you know, there is something to be learned there. And I'm very grateful that we now have folks like Christy, you know, and Misty and others on our side who are now engaging legislators on a daily basis. And I think for our movement, it's making all the difference in the world.
Well, inciting 30,000 Americans who were fatally shot in 2015, the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, your group, says that in the face of that, Congress did nothing but offer, quote, their thoughts and prayers, hollow gestures meant to appease the public while placating the gun lobby. Are there any other instances where Congress does nothing in the face of mounting evidence of things that need to be done and then comes out with platitudes?
I personally don't know of any other circumstance where there is such a huge loss of life and the politicians do nothing.
And your group, Lad, the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, takes it a step further. You describe the NRA's interpretation of the Second Amendment as treasonous, saying that it amounts to insurrectionism. How so?
Well, absolutely. I mean, look at what's happening right now at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. You know, where do you think guys like Clive and Bundy got the idea that the Second Amendment gives them a right to essentially take up arms against the government whenever they disagree with a court decision or a law? Let's be very clear here. They got that idea directly from the National Rifle Association. The National Rifle Association has been, you know, basically promoting that insurrectionist interpretation of the Second Amendment for 4 decades now. And that's why I was getting, you know, that's why I think it's important to get into a much more nuanced and intelligent discussion about what the Second Amendment was really about. Our founders did not intend it to allow for insurrection. In fact, in the Constitution, it states explicitly that the purpose of our militia is to, and I quote, suppress insurrections, not to foment them. So I think at some point this country needs to get back to an intelligent debate about the Second Amendment. And as I stated earlier, not only did it not countenance insurrection, there was never even any mention of individual self-defense against criminals when our founders were debating the amendment.
How do you have that intelligent conversation in an atmosphere in which, don't confuse me with the facts, seems to run supreme, where I have a set of beliefs and I will not be shaken in those beliefs, and anybody who doesn't support me 100% is a traitor? If you compromise to the point of 80%, you're a traitor. How do you have that intelligent conversation?
We accept that there's some people that fetishize firearms to the point where they're intimately intertwined with their self-esteem and identity, and that we're never going to convince those people that reducing gun violence is a necessary goal.
Can women?
But there are so many people in the middle that we can reach and we need to reach.
Can women, can moms be more successful at this than men?
Well, we are a pretty powerful organization, and, you know,
well, moms are pretty powerful, period.
Right. I don't know about you, but if my mom tells me to do something, I usually do it, you know, because, you know, that's my mom. But seriously, though, one of our assets is that we are we're kinder and we're smarter and move in a different way than the gun lobby moves when we operate at the legislature. We got, you know, tons of feedback when we were lobbying last summer that they loved hearing from moms and they loved talking to us.
Did they take action as a result of loving hearing from you?
I think they did. I think our influence is what kept that background check and pistol permit process on the law. And, you know, speaking back to the email, you know, you don't need to move out of North Carolina. You can just vote, you know, vote for legislators that are going to change the gun laws and make us safer by closing those loopholes.
We've asked on the radio a minute ago in the break to share your questions and comments with us. We posted on social media too. Tanner emails, committing a crime with a gun is already breaking the law. So what are more laws going to do? They broke the law to get the gun. They broke the law to commit the crime. What's another law to them? What's the answer to that, Lad Everett?
I think that's laughable. We live in a country where most mass shooters who have a zillion red flags in their background indicating history of violence legally get their guns. I'm talking about people like Jared Loughner, the mentally ill Arizona shooter, the Tucson shooter, James Holmes from Aurora, who told his psychiatrist that he wanted to kill her and commit mass murder and still legally bought his gun. You know, that's laughable. We have the weakest laws in the civilized world. There is no country who is a close second. We're doing nothing to prevent violent individuals from getting guns. So I'm not sure what laws that individual is talking about, but I have yet to see them.
Well, in the case of a person telling their therapist, their psychiatrist, their psychologist that they'd like to kill them and commit mass murder, isn't there, I'm going to call it doctor-patient confidentiality? Do we need to change that law in some way?
Well, I just think we need more opportunities for intervention. One example I would bring up is a new law that California has called the Gun Violence Restraining Order Law. That law was put in place after the Isla Vista shooting, where Elliot Roger had a welfare check. His parents requested a welfare check for him because they believed him to be suicidal. He had handguns. Law enforcement came out to his apartment, talked to him, but they couldn't seize the guns. They had no authority to do so. That shooting could have been prevented, but the law wasn't there to do so. So those are the types of interventions we need. Let's be clear, and I want to restate this because it's an important point. Most of our mass shooters are clearly dangerous. Everyone around them knows they're a threat. That includes family, law enforcement, who in most cases has had multiple contacts with these individuals, their classmates, you name it. And yet we're not allowing for any interventions whatsoever to prevent them from buying guns, and if they have them, to get guns out of their hands, even if it's only temporarily during a period of crisis. This is idiotic. There's no other free nation that allows this to happen, and it's entirely correctable.
Chris emails, I'm curious whether there's any sound, peer-reviewed statistical or economic evidence that gun control in the U.S. will reduce gun violence. The premise really has to be established before a meaningful conversation could proceed. Any comment on that? Any empirical evidence?
Yes. If you go to everytown.org, there is a whole section called Learn, and through there you can see the empirical evidence that shows that closing the background check loophole is proven to reduce gun violence. In states that already have that loophole closed, 46% fewer women die from gun violence and 48% fewer police officers are shot in the line of duty. And so that just shows that if you close those loopholes, you can reduce gun violence.
And you call this an epidemic, this gun violence. You call it an epidemic of gun violence, and you've also described it as a public health crisis in which nearly 8 children are shot and killed every day. Now, far fewer children, I believe, died during last year's bad flu season, and the media was in a tizzy over the flu. Far fewer people have even contracted the Zika virus, and yet in both cases, we're once again covering it like the bubonic plague is overtaking us. Is it simply the NRA and the Second Amendment that's the roadblock here, or is there more to it than that?
Well, the gun lobby definitely puts up a roadblock to preventing gun violence. That is one of their objectives, is, you know, to make sure that there aren't new laws put on the books. And, you know, when a child is shot and killed by their own hand or someone else's hand, is a huge tragedy, and it only gets, you know, maybe a 10-second blip on the news. And that's why we're here. We're here to call attention to that, and we're called to be that resounding voice for gun violence victims and survivors, and to work, you know, we work tirelessly to change these laws, to save these lives, because they're all preventable.
Lad Everett, your organization, Coalition Stop Gun Violence, has put elected officials on notice, you say, saying that the era of no accountability is over. If you do the NRA's bidding and put our loved ones in the line of fire, we will educate your constituents about your record. I take it you've started doing that. What kind of reaction have you gotten from elected officials?
Well, I think a good one. Look, I mean, we're, like we talked about earlier, we're living in an era of money politics. We might remember an era in the past where principled politics was in play. That was a long time ago, probably at this point, but not anymore. Most politicians constantly have to raise money to stay in office, and many of them are focused solely on their own personal power. And, you know, I think for very long, the gun violence prevention movement was too polite, too friendly. We allowed our friends to stab us in the back, and we kind of look the other way and do nothing. That's come to an end now, and I think it's benefited us immensely. I think we have to understand that in this era, it's probably better to be respected than liked. And again, that might be another message, or lesson rather, that we can take from the gun lobby.
Is this an uphill battle? Do you see it as such, or do you see yourselves making headway in this, Misty?
I think we are making a tremendous difference, especially with the Be Smart campaign Moms Demand Action has created. I think it's important to know that 273 children across the country in 2015 were shot by unsecured and loaded weapon, and seven of those were in North Carolina. So I am out there to put the word out there to be smart about stuff like this. So I definitely think that it is making a difference.
Mr. Uribe is a Be Smart lead for the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America organization, of which Christy Clark is also the North Carolina chapter leader. And Lad Everett joined us from Washington. He's the director of communications for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Charlotte talks.